The View from the Lane is brought to you by Bet365, the world's favourite online betting company. By downloading the Bet365 app, you can access both pre-match and in-play markets, along with instant match updates for all games. The Bet365 Bet Builder also allows you to make personalised bets via the app, so you can bet on multiple scenarios and create your own bet with unique odds right there in your hands. Bet365 is the world's favourite online sport betting company. The app can be downloaded from Google Play and Apple App Store. Over 18s only. Please gamble responsibly. Hello and welcome to what can only be described as an emergency mailbag edition of The View from the Lane, our Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. My name is Jack Pitbrook and I'm joined again today by James Moore and Charlie Eccleshare. Not today in the same room in central London, but in fact scattered all over the place. So last night was a big night for Tottenham. If you are listening to this podcast, you'll know exactly why. So today at The Athletic, we've decided to take 113 questions from Spurs fans mainly. We've answered 10 of them on a mailbag article, which you can read now on theathletic.com. But right now, we're going to answer some of the other questions that we didn't get through to in the mailbag. So we're going to start with Lee R, who says, I would love to see a nominated player allowed to go into the crowd after every game to administer punishment beatings to fans, as most of them are absolutely clueless and should have been strangled at birth. Now, I should say that this is not the official line of The Athletic.
It's also not actually a question.
It's also not a question. But what do you think? What does it make you feel?
it makes me fear for the professional integrity of this podcast. Do you want me to answer that question or a reply to that statement with a suggestion?
Run with it.
I do wonder if Spurs probably are lacking a hard man, and that's kind of the problem, isn't it? I'm not sure there's anyone. I mean, Dyer would probably be the one you'd say was the toughest cookie in that group, I'd say.
Dyer's the closest. Yeah, I mean, this is what Mourinho was talking about, wasn't he? Them being too nice the other day.
Exactly, I mean, you know, if Harry Winks comes into the crowd, no one's going to be terrified, are they?
I think the question is interesting. I mean, obviously, very amusing, but I think there was a lot of sympathy towards Dyer, it feels like. That's, you know, the overwhelming impression I get from social media, from the mailbag, from the comments under the Dyer article that Jack and I wrote. You know, seems to be, well, obviously no one's going to condone this sort of behaviour, but there is this sense from fans that they can say and do whatever they want without any sort of consequence. And actually, a lot of the stuff players have to deal with is just not really on.
Charlie, do you think that's because Dyer himself is an especially popular player with the Spurs fans? Or do you think that fans in general have some loyalty to the players over what they see as more toxic elements in the fan base?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think Dyer, there's probably partly an element there because, as you say, he is well liked and he's thought to be, you know, a pretty thoughtful, smart character. But I just feel like we've reached a bit of a tipping point with you know, things like social media and this sort of mob mentality where people feel like they can do whatever they want. And I just feel like there's a bit of a backlash against that, that actually you shouldn't be able to do that. And it's sort of all come together at this moment. And I think there's a bit of, you know, as that question alludes to, I think a lot of supporters, depending on where you sit, get frustrated with some of the views put forward by other fans, especially by fans who don't go every week, and there's a sense of entitlement, which we're led to believe, you know, this fan fits in more that sort of category, if not someone who goes a lot and, you know, was just shouting his mouth off. So that's my reading of it. But I don't know, James, how do you feel from where you're sat?
I mean, Eric Dyer seems like a really weird target, not just off the back of that game where not only did he actually score his penalty, he also, I mean, played pretty well, really. But, I mean, in terms of the players you'd expect to get abuse from fans, you wouldn't really expect it to be a sort of, you know, hardworking, long-serving, sort of tough defensive player. You'd kind of expect it to be an erratic or bumbling sort of attacking player or you know, a clownish third-choice goalkeeper, maybe. Yeah, so for Dier to be the one who was getting stick did seem a bit weird. I mean, I think Mourinho's quotes after the game sort of hinted at a feeling that perhaps this person wasn't like a kind of big Spurs fan. And in that part of the ground, as you've written in the piece that's gone out on The Athletic today, it is a lot of sort of corporate hospital. I mean, not corporate hospitality, but kind of, you know, corporate seats and friends and family and seats that are given away and whatever else. Maybe it is more of a hanger-on than a, you know, like a kind of die-hard fan. But, I mean, it's just... I think you're right. And people are kind of fed up of seeing, you know, anyone in the public eye get abuse and just have to take it. And, it kind of stands to reason that eventually someone's going to snap. And if he, as we're led to believe, has seen his brother, you know, bear the brunt of the abuse from this guy, then I don't really think it's a massive surprise that he's wanted to do something about that. And we should also point out there's not really any suggestion that there was any kind of massively violent altercation when this happened. He just tried to sort of front up to the guy and have a word with him, and that seems to have been the long and short of it, really.
James, you touched on something quite important there, because the fact that, as you say, Eric Dier, there's no reason why he should be a target or anything like that, but I think that's almost the point, that there are some people who go to games and they'll just abuse anyone. You know, anyone they see, they'll just think is fair game. So it almost feels like this guy just saw Dier and was like, oh, there's a Spurs player, I'll just, you know, chuck abuse at him. It was almost like arbitrary, and that's just all the more worrying in a way.
I mean, without wanting to make excuses for it, and I'm certainly not doing that, but I think the cost of going to football matches, I think, may sort of tie into that mentality a bit now. And people have such high expectations of what they're going to get for their money now. They want to see every single player in that team play absolutely fantastically every single game, because they're playing, you know, 40, 50, 60 pounds for a match, possibly not in this case, but in general terms. And I think that has kind of fed into a culture of sort of failure being completely unacceptable. And it is, you know, it is that kind of Arsenal fan TV sort of mindset whereby, you know, any kind of misplaced pass or mistake on the ball or, you know, defensive error is, you know, is absolutely criminal, rather than just being something that you will see in every single football match and will have seen in any match in the history of the game.
Yeah.
James, do you sense that it's getting worse in the last few months or the last year or so at the brand new stadium?
I'd say that the kind of enjoyable atmospheres have been probably few and far between at that stadium, to be honest. I mean, the first few games were amazing, but as last season wore on, and Spurs basically sort of winning games there, it became a kind of quite a flat atmosphere. Not kind of actively bad, but sort of just a bit, you know, like a bit of a sort of shrug of the shoulders, really. Like, there wasn't really a lot to it. You know, a home game against West Ham, for example, at the back end of last season, which should be the kind of, you know, the first London derby, the second London derby, if you want to include Crystal Palace, which you probably should, really. But, you know, the first proper London derby and the new stadium against West Ham. And it was just really flat. And it wasn't, you know, that was partly down to the fact Spurs were in the Champions League semi-finals and that was more important. But it didn't have the kind of feel that game would have had at White Hart Lane, the original White Hart Lane. And yeah, this season, I mean, you know, if you look at the Chelsea game this season, I mean, you know, what happened with Rudiger is kind of an ongoing question. But that moment, regardless of what actually happens, that moment where Son was sent off in that corner of the ground and everyone was, you know, shouting and moaning and whatever else, that was a pretty horrible moment, regardless of whether or not anything racist was said by anyone. It was horrible.
From hearing a few fans, you know, they feel like the atmosphere, you know, isn't what it was at White Hart Lane. And I just feel like a slight echo, obviously nowhere near as extreme, of the Upton Park to London Stadium move. If that's like the sort of gold standard for a terrible drop in atmosphere, do you feel Spurs is like anywhere near that? Is it comparable, or is it just inevitable?
It's nowhere near as bad as that. I mean, I've been to London Stadium twice in the away end of Spurs, and the first time on the Friday night game, it was pretty lively at the end, but nothing particularly sensational. And the second time on a Saturday lunchtime, was really flat.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see West Ham's situation being quite different to Spurs, because not only have, you know, they've moved away from home, their ground isn't in the same place, they've not got the same routines that Spurs fans have been allowed to or been able to maintain in this ground being built on the same site effectively.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is just a slightly different experience. It's not, you're not quite as close to the pitch, even if it is a lot closer than the Emirates or the London Stadium or Wembley. You know, there's just, it's just so much more vast that it's just difficult to generate that kind of atmosphere, I think. And it will take time probably for that to kind of work, really. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's just a feeling of it that it doesn't feel quite right. It doesn't feel completely alien, but it still doesn't feel quite right.
Next question from Mark A. Why is the team so negative? We look like we did under AVB. No inspiration and relying on one player who's only arrived this season. Charlie, what do you think?
I'm not sure how much I go in for that narrative, to be honest. Like, you know, all the numbers are up for they've actually scored a lot of goals. They haven't defended very well. I don't think it's been all that negative. I mean, in the last couple of weeks, obviously, without any, you know, available strikers, it's been a bit more, certainly in the Chelsea game. But then Wolves at home was chaotic. It wasn't negative, I don't think. And then yesterday, they were ahead for most of the game. And yes, they did drop too deep in that second half. And it did feel like an equaliser was coming. But I don't know. I don't think, you know, there have been lots of problems with this team. And you can talk about it not really functioning. But I'm not sure negative is necessarily the first criticism I'd level at them.
James, do you think the issue is that they're so pragmatic that they change between attack and defence too quickly from game to game?
I'm not sure I'd say that either. I mean, as Charlie says, in the last maybe two or three games, their attacking play has actually probably been quite a lot better. And to be honest, I don't think Mourinho is necessarily completely wrong when he says that they were maybe slightly unfortunate not to have won that game over 120 minutes last night. You know, they had a few opportunities. They had the shot off the line, I think, we're in the 90th minute, perhaps. And, you know, Norwich maybe only had one or two other chances, not really particularly good ones. The goal they did score was obviously from an error as well. So clearly they're a long way off the level they want to be at. But I don't necessarily think that the problem is how attacking or how defensive they are. It's just that the quality just hasn't been there. And it just looks like it's just kind of too many sort of, you know, slumped shoulders and players that look like they're playing within themselves or with a, you know, without confidence. It doesn't feel quite like everyone is pulling in the same direction at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't say that the issue is that they're too defensive, and if they were more attacking, then they'd be fine. I mean, look how bad they are at defending. Like, they can see.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it would be worse if they flew out all the time. I think they'd be doing much worse.
And you can't separate like the reality of the players they've got available from the tactics that Mourinho wants to use. Like, I think one of the reasons why the tactics are all over the place is because the squad is so incoherent and patchy.
I mean, that feels a bit like the negative thing feels a bit like we've talked about of kind of framing everything in this Mourinho sort of way. And just on that, I wondered what you guys made of a few people were suggesting yesterday that, you know, the Dyer incident was, you know, partly a result of the atmosphere fostered by Mourinho. And I just don't really see that personally. Like, that, no. I didn't read it in that way. And I wondered what you guys thought.
I don't really think that stands up to any scrutiny, to be honest, at all.
Okay, here's one from Matthew P. It isn't Jose's fault that a prime Walker, prime Rose, prime Dembele and prime Wanyama have been slowly allowed to leave without sufficient replacements. Spurs are generating record levels of revenue and Enoch are doing a good job long term for the club. Providing this money will eventually be reinvested into the team, but Spurs fans need to be reassured of that. Will Jose be given money to rebuild the squad to compete? Charlie, what do you reckon?
A lot of it is about Champions League qualification. It sounds like if they don't get that, then it's not going to be massive. You know, certainly not, I think, at the level that fans will be hoping for and what they feel they need for a big rebuild. I mean, it is increasingly looking like, you know, there are a good few players off being where they want to be. And in this market, a good few players off is, what, like 150 million or something like that? And they're not going to get that if they don't qualify for the Champions League. So I don't know. I mean, like, we've talked about this before. You know, Pochettino knew that it was time for a turnover of players. I just wonder if that will be accelerated in the summer. We've seen a few players go already, but none have really brought in big fees. I just wonder if do you at that point, if you don't make the Champions League, do you start thinking about selling players to bring others in?
They're going to have to do that, aren't they? I just don't see it, none of the kind of fringe players that you would say you would want rid of, irrespective of fees, look like they're going to really bring in much money. I can't really see anyone there who, you know, I mean, who's going to be able to be sold for sort of 20 or 30 million pounds now, unless you're kind of selling people like Sissoko or, you know, maybe Aurier, maybe you'd get a decent fee. But I mean, I just don't, you know, I think they're going to struggle. Having not sold Christian Eriksen for 60, 70, 80 million pounds, as I perhaps would have preferred to have done, suddenly now they've found themselves with quite a big shortfall in terms of rebuilding this team.
Yeah, I'd agree with Charlie. I think it all comes down to Champions League. I think as it stands, Tottenham are very keen to do, you know, to bring in quite a few players in the summer. But if they're not in the Champions League, it's going to be very difficult. It might well be they get saved by the Manchester City situation. They can't really rely on that. I don't get the impression that they're close to where they need to be, frankly, watching them play at the moment. And which leads us on to our next question from Matthew P. What positions are Spurs prioritising for the summer? I mean, guys, where do we start? There's about four or five.
I mean, I'd say you're looking at it now and you definitely need someone else in central midfield, I think. You need what I think your friend Jose Mourinho would call a positional central midfield player. Have I got that right?
No, like just a positional midfielder. Basically. Yeah, no central.
Positional midfielder. Okay, apologies. So this is like a sitting midfield player, yeah. Basically. Someone who's going to kind of act as a defensive shield and allow Lo Celso and or Winks and or Ndombele or whoever else the license to play. And that's clearly something that's lacking, because Dier has looked quite a long way off the pace when he's played in that position in the last few months. And obviously now Wanyama, the other player who you'd say was of that mould, is now left. So that would be the main one. I think I've
what
made
about Ollie Skip there, James? What did you think of him yesterday?
I mean, he probably wasn't quite as good as Jose Mourinho was suggesting after the match. I think, outstanding was the word he used, I believe.
Phenomenal.
And I think he sort of talked himself down as the sentence progressed. It was sort of phenomenal, outstanding, quite good, okay, as he was kind of going along. I mean, he'd be the kind of player I think you want to see sent out on loan now. I think now we're kind of out of this Pochettino, inspired system of not sending young players out on loan. I think he would be one that I think maybe would benefit from actually.
Do you think so? You don't think he's ready to play more often?
I don't think he's ready to play like in big matches, in the Champions League or the kind of, you know, top six battles in the Premier League. But I suppose if Spurs are in the Europa League, perhaps there are fixtures there that he could play in. But yeah, as for other positions, I'd say right back. I mean, I think I made my thoughts on Serge Aurier quite clear over the course of the last few weeks. Maybe left back. I mean, it dependent on, you know, whether or not Sessegnon is seen as an option there. I mean, it's kind of hard to say at this stage, given he's injured again. Another centre forward, probably at least one centre back. There's quite a lot there really on the list, isn't there?
It's crazy. It does show you how hard squad building is. That you need to do it. You need to gradually evolve it over time. Because if you don't, you're in a situation where you're listing like pretty much a whole new team, and that's just never going to happen.
But this is what we were talking about in the previous pod, that in those two windows, the summer of 2018 and the January of 2019, where Spurs didn't sign anybody, they missed out on the opportunity to bring in players that they could then bed in to kind of be hitting their stride around about now or during the course of this season. And that kind of feels like the sort of talent gap that Spurs are suffering from now. The fact that they've not brought in, you know, I mean, I think the two players we mentioned that Spurs have been linked with in that summer, I think were Grealish and Pereira. And those are obviously two positions, you know, another creative player, a goal scorer, a creator of goals, and a competent right back are two things that, you know, Spurs could certainly have done with over the course of this season. So, and it just feels like, you know, that's the problem, really. The recruitment actually in the last year, you would look at it in the longer term and say perhaps has been pretty good. But it's just the fact that they didn't sign anyone before that's now left them sort of in this position where there are some players at their peak, but there are a lot of players who are kind of on the way up and who are still kind of hoping to get there, and a few who are now sort of just like starting to kind of creep down the downward slope. And it just feels like there aren't enough players quite at the peak of their powers.
Right, let's do two more quick questions before we wrap up. The penultimate question is from Callum R. my reaction to Mourinho's comments on Burnley and Leipzig, if you don't know, sorry, that was Mourinho saying that he could focus on one game but not both of them. My reaction to Mourinho's comments wasn't great, but what will the board's reaction be, Charlie?
Yeah, I think this might have been slightly overstated. You know, I don't know if there's going to... I think some people are imagining, you know, Mourinho is going to storm into the boardroom and be like, guys, we need to talk. And I don't think it'll really happen that way. You know, he's in pretty regular contact with Daniel Levy. And, you know, I think part of this, from what I understand, it was an attempt to relieve some of the pressure on the players because, you know, it was basically making the point that they've played a huge amount of football at the moment and a lot of them are dead on their feet, which, you know, I think a lot of them are. So I don't think it will quite play out like that. And I don't think the board will sort of kick off with him in anger. I mean, again, our understanding was that the board wouldn't really interfere too much in playing matters, which is, you know, what you'd expect. I mean, I do think as well... there is a certain logic in what he was saying. I know it's like seems like anti-football and all of that, but you know they have played a huge amount of football. It is going to be very, very difficult. And let's be realistic as well. The run they're on at the moment, it will be Sunday, Wednesday, Saturday, Tuesday. That is a very compressed schedule with a depleted squad. I think what will happen is they'll go to Burnley and try as hard as they can to get something there and then basically see where they are because... You can't, I don't think you can, you know, not take that game seriously. There's just too much at stake. And I just think if you go there with an undercooked team, you're in trouble potentially.
I mean, aside from anything else, I think if you go to Burnley, leave a couple of players out, don't have the right mentality and you get beaten, you know, a sort of 3-0 defeat akin to the game at Brighton in October, then, you know, what position does that put you in going into that Leipzig game anyway? When they've had such a chastening experience in the first leg, where are the heads going to be if they've just been battered by Burnley on a Saturday afternoon? I mean, that's not going to be any good at all. So yeah, I would completely agree with Charlie. They'll fully focus on the Burnley game and then see where they are after that. I would agree as well that those comments. I mean, it's kind of like an inconvenient truth, really, isn't it? You just wonder whether it might be something that perhaps he should have just kept to himself. I mean, that isn't a reflection on my stance on global warming, by the way. it's just, you know, I just find it hard to imagine other top managers would. I mean, maybe Guardiola might have used it as a kind of motivational tool for his players, but someone like Klopp or Pochettino, I just don't see would have allowed their players to kind of think that negatively, because that ultimately to me is how that feels. It feels like you're giving those players an excuse to lose.
Yeah, I quite agree, but I also agree with you that they have, you know, if it's one or the other, it has to be Burnley, doesn't it? The Champions League is so hard to win that you have to take your chances of getting beaten again by Leipzig and then just go all in to try and stay in the Champions League for next season. I know that's really, really negative and this is why football is bad in the 21st century, but it is also what I think.
But I do think like their approach basically is let's try and get to mid-April, still be in the mix, get Kane and Son back and have a 4 or 5 game run at it. And going out the FA Cup, at least the one positive is it does mean fewer matches and they could do with that at the moment.
Yeah, certainly. Okay, so one last question from Edward H. before we wrap up. James, this one's for you. How long before we start to think about a managerial change at the end of the season?
did I mean how long do I start to think about it until I start to think about it? I mean, that's just not going to happen. Purely on the basis of how long Mourinho's contract is and how much it's going to cost to terminate that contract ahead of time. There's just absolutely no chance that would happen. Purely on the financial terms, even if you ignore, you know, how kind of Levy won't be keen to kind of be seen to have made the wrong decision there. And the fact, you know, if we're being realistic, it is ludicrous to suggest that Mourinho should be judged too harshly on what's happened in the last few months, given, you know, he arrived to such chaos in November. So, I mean, that certainly won't be something that happens in the summer. Whether or not it happens at this point next year, if things are still going badly, who's to say? But I mean, from a fan's perspective, I certainly don't from what I've seen, it's kind of mixed at best for Mourinho, and there are certainly a lot of people who aren't particularly convinced.
Oh yeah, I don't think you know, it's going to be a discussion point at all. I mean, I think he does have quite a lot of goodwill. You know, the people who hired him, I think they understand that, you know, circumstances have been difficult, both with the injuries, but also coming in midway through a season and all of that. So I think for the people who are actually making these decisions and whose opinions matter, I think there's a lot of reserving of judgment. So yeah, we're a long way off from a point where his position is in question.
What I would say is that when Daniel Levy first arrived at the club, he very quickly got rid of an unpopular manager who was doing reasonably well in George Graham. He'd won the League Cup and he just got Spurs to the 2001 FA Cup semi-final, got sacked, and Hoddle was brought in, and that just really just didn't work at all, or certainly not as he would have hoped. So I do wonder whether that might be the kind of thing he has in mind when you know, fan pressure starts to kind of take hold.
But also, Graham wasn't his hire, was he? So I think he's got such a stake in this working.
Yeah, I can't see. It would be such a humiliating admission that he got his biggest ever call wrong to get rid of Mourinho now. Whatever you think of Mourinho, it's just, I cannot see it happening. I just think it's completely implausible that Mourinho would go anytime soon.
The big call was getting rid of Pochettino. Those two calls, I think, are probably independent, really, aren't they? The big one was sacking Pochettino. The secondary one maybe was bringing in Mourinho. I guess those two things you had to kind of look at as two decisions.
Yeah, I suppose so. The way I've always linked them in my head is that appointing Mourinho is the only way he could sell sacking Pochettino. He knew it would be so painful to sack Spurs' best manager since Nicholson that the only way he could justify it to people, maybe even to himself, was to get, you know, the most successful manager of the last 20 years.
But I think that's a really... I think, like, he may view it in that way, but I think for a lot of the fans, it almost made it worse because you've lost Pochettino and then you're bringing in someone who a lot of fans really didn't like. I don't think a lot of fans saw it as, oh, well, at least we've brought Mourinho in. I think they were like, oh, it's even worse now. We've brought in a guy who's like the anti-Poch.
Yeah, I agree. And I also sense, and, you know, I'm very willing to be correct on this, but I sense that, like, the dial of Spurs fans' opinions is moving towards, oh God, this is, you know, we shouldn't have done this. This was a bad decision. I wish Pochettino was still here, relative to, say, a few months ago. I think there was more optimism. But James, what's your reading of that particular dynamic? Yeah.
I mean, I'd say that was probably fairly accurate. I mean, there are certainly, from what I've seen in some of the conversations I've had, there are definitely some sort of militantly pro-Jose factions out there. But there's at least one person who is now pretty concerned that this perhaps isn't going to work, not on the basis of tactical things, but more on the basis of the kind of atmosphere around the club at the moment that feels quite fragmented, which is kind of the antithesis of Pochettino's strength, really, which was to get everyone, you know, on the same page and everyone feeling like it was one club, one entity, everyone pulling in the same direction, to use a horrible cliche, possibly not for the first time on this podcast. Now it feels like a very different football club all of a sudden. It's not quite as enjoyable an experience.
Okay, guys, I think we've already run over our allocated time for this afternoon, but thanks very much for joining us. Listeners, thank you very much for listening as well. If you want to read our big mailbag piece on theathletic.com, if you're not already a subscriber, you can get 40% off of subscription with promo code SPURSPOD. Otherwise, we will be back at the start of next week when Charlie will be in Leipzig covering Spurs' Champions League last 16 second leg, and he will be looking back at the Burnley game on Saturday evening. We look forward to joining you again then.